Camp Hell and Awakey is a production of iHeartRadio. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the author and participants and do not necessarily represent those of iHeartMedia or its employees. Due to discussion of traumatic, sexual, and violent content, listener discretion is advised.
The whole episode was almost surreal. I moved to Atlanta in 1967 and became a graduate student, needed money. So I looked under psychologists in the phone book in the Yellow Pages, and there was something called Annie Wakey Foundation. And I said, what the dickens is that?
This is Roger Brin. He was an early employee at Annie Wakey. Today, he is a clinical psychologist and currently practices in Huntsville, Alabama.
First person I talked to was Lewis Petter. And on the phone, he asked my credentials. He said, you're exactly what I'm looking for. And so I drove out to his offices. Lewis Petter came out and introduced himself to me, and we sat in his office, and he hired me on the spot. I was probably there 15 minutes. He said, do you want to work with us? It sounded like a fun, exciting place. I thought I could grow. He basically made me the clinical director. There was no other mental health person on the campus per se. Now, he had a license to practice psychology, but had been grandfathered. And he had doctor in front of his name. I didn't know for several months what that meant, but he had an honorary doctorate degree. And from that point on, I thought he was a real psychologist.
When medical licensing laws came into play in the United States, if you already had a master's degree and had been practicing psychology for a number of years, you were able to obtain a license as a one-time clause. Roger explained that this would not fly today, but at the time, you were grandfathered in. Such was the case with Annie Wakey's founder, Lewis Petter.
There was no training, number one. It was all on the job. The boys were required to build their own lodging. They did a lot of their own cooking. They had to make sure that they stayed in groups and worked in groups and teams. I'd been there about 6 months, and of course it took me a while to get acclimated to the camp. And at the same time, I started thinking there were some unusual things, but we started suspecting that there was some kind of sexual misconduct. Couldn't prove it, kids wouldn't admit it, so we sort of hung in there to see what we could find out.
Over the past several weeks, we have received a number of very serious allegations concerning both the facility out there and a number of individuals involved with it.
It was just a form of their therapy. They were told to do it, and at the time, he was 14 and a half, 15 years old. They didn't know any better.
I asked him, why are you letting this happen? Why are you covering up for Louis Petter? He had no answers to that question.
The thought of having an institution paid in a hospital to be such a despicable place and to do absolutely the contrary of what they should have done.
I'm disturbed over the fact that something is still going on at Annie Wakey.
I'm Josh Thane, and this is Camp Hell, Annie Wakey. In speaking with former patients and employees of Annie Wakey, I heard a range of experiences, some heartbreaking, some inspiring, and some that were straight horrific. To understand what led to these experiences, we need to look at how this institution was initially set up, what were its purposes, and why were so many parents sending their children there? I tried to find anyone who could give me an idea of what the early days of Annie Wakey were like.
It was out in the woods. There was a dirt road going into it outside Douglasville. It was still a dirt road. The Annie Wakey sign was there and a path where the A-buildings are going to be built. Down below that was the small little schoolroom and one lodge. And then as you go down into the campsite, there was a tool room and stuff. My name is Richard Edgerly. I got recruited there in 1965. My number was E79.
That means Richard was only the 79th person to attend Annie Wakey. He says he was admitted when he was around the age of 10 or 11.
The lake was being built. It wasn't quite finished because I worked on that for, I would say, a month before they filled it up. The cabins had just received power. In fact, the place where they stuck the poles in it was still flat, so it hadn't had time to grow up.
Annie Wakey Lake still sits in Douglasville and can easily be seen on any map. This was one of Richard's original work projects while attending.
In the beginning was the lake. That's what everybody was working on, the lake. Clearing stumps, burning the wood, the grass cutting with sling blades. Lots of trail building because everything was new. We lined all our trails with rocks. We used to have competitions to see who could move the biggest rock. In fact, the one my friend and I did is still sitting there exactly where it sat 50 years ago. We stained the cabins. We built two extensions. They weren't finished totally. A couple of the cabins had the foundation for an add-on to the building, and it wasn't done. During my time, we knocked down the wall and built that extension. During that time, we installed heating panels. And 20 years ago when I went out there, they were still hanging and they were still working.
The day-to-day for patients at Anoka'i was set by a self-planned schedule. It was to be followed by the letter.
On Sundays, we have to write a schedule of everything we did for that week from morning till night. 5:30, we would wake up. 5:45, we would get dressed. 6 o'clock, we would assemble as a group. 6:10, we would move to the lodge. We would have to walk around the lake. 7 o'clock was breakfast, always 30 minutes. 8 o'clock, we'd go to the tool room, check out the tools, depending on what we had to do that day, axes, rakes, whatever. We'd actually go to whatever project it was, cutting grass, lining trails, building things in the camp, helping other groups build their stuff, cleaning out sewage ponds, painting, staining. 11 o'clock, we would stop, clean up, 12 o'clock lunch. 1 o'clock, we'd go back to work. At 3:30, 4 o'clock, we would stop, move back to the lodge, and the thing again would happen with dinner. 30 minutes after that, we went back to our campsites and had a group meeting. It could range anywhere 6:30, 7 o'clock, and that was in the back of the campsite, split logs around a fire pit. The group would sit there and talk and work out our problems and say what happened during the day. And then after that, we'd have free time activities, letter writing, showers, whatever we needed to do, and then 2100 around there with lights out. Wasn't that bad. It kept you busy and you had your friends, and in fact, you didn't have any time to think hardly at all.
This rigid daily structure provided the patients of Anoka'i with a predictable routine, a widely accepted strategy to reduce problem behaviors in children with emotional behavioral issues. So what does it mean to be diagnosed with an emotional behavioral issue? The answer is more complicated than you may think. I went to speak with an expert who could shed some light on the subject.
My name is Steve Truscott. I am a professor at Georgia State University in the school psychology program.
And I'm Catherine Perkins, and I'm also a professor in school psychology at Georgia State.
I asked Steve and Catherine to explain what it means to have a child with emotional behavioral issues.
One of the things that is probably going to make your story complicated is that there are multiple systems for determining whether a child has an emotional or behavior disorder. And within those systems, there are different definitions. There's a legal system, there's an educational system, and then there's a system of psychiatric kind of disorders. And they overlap some, but they're not the same. So I'll give you a for instance. The classification using the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual identifies about 10% of the U.S. population of children as having an emotional or behavioral disorder, whereas the school-based definition, only about a little less than 1% of kids are kids who are classified as having an emotional or behavior disorder. So there's a disparity between those. And part of the disparity is that the criteria are different. So the criteria for a special education for the label of EBD in Georgia, that's another thing, is the labels change across the states. But in Georgia, it's EBD. The label requires there to be an educational impact.
Basically, the term emotional behavioral issue is not a universal standard. What qualifies as emotionally disturbed changes depending on the context in which it is determined, whether it be by a school, hospital, or otherwise. This is something that would give Anoka'i enough wiggle room to claim anyone could be accepted based on the facility's standards.
Emotional behavioral disturbance is the label that was given by the federal government that's in this law, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, that specifies what students qualify for special education in public schools. That's what that label is. And then, like my colleague pointed out, there are other labeling systems that are more medically oriented, or, you know, the judicial system has their own label, which is guilty or not guilty. And so it's a little confusing. But the federal law for special education clearly outlines the criteria that you're looking at to determine if a child meets that criteria for emotional behavioral disturbance.
There isn't a definitive way to say this kid does and this kid doesn't have that disability.
Catherine and Steve pointed out that just because a child is labeled as emotionally disturbed, that doesn't make that criteria the same in Georgia as it may be in Alabama or Florida. This term is a blanket that could be used in a number of situations. Some of these would not only include school, but also the judiciary system.
The definition in Georgia is based on five primary concerns. The first one is an inability to build or maintain satisfactory interpersonal relationships with peers and/or teachers. An inability to learn, which cannot be adequately explained by intellectual, sensory, or health factors. The third one is a consistent or chronic inappropriate type of behavior or feelings under normal situations. The fourth is a displayed pervasive mood of unhappiness or depression. And the last one is a displayed tendency to develop physical symptoms, pains, or unreasonable fears associated with personal or school problems. So those are kind of the five hallmarks of students who are identified as having EBD. So here's how I think of it. There's typical childhood development, you know, the way most kids grow and learn. And then sometimes the kind of behaviors that we're talking about when we're talking about EBD, they may be perfectly typical and normal, but then if they persist into other developmental stages, they might look very different. So, for example, many people talk about the terrible twos, where you have, you know, tantrum behavior and very young children who are trying to find their way in the world and are trying to assert their power and their choice and their decision making. And then if they don't get their way, they let you know they're not happy about that. But that same tantrum behavior that would be typical with a two-year-old starts looking very different in a school-aged child. And so it's when these behaviors persist with frequency, intensity, and duration beyond that that is seen in typically developing children, that's when we start saying, oh, that's problematic.
And how do parents react when faced with this type of situation? And how did so many come to the conclusion that Anna Wakey was the answer? I spoke with Richard Dressler. He part-time serves as a motivational speaker, helping families deal with crisis. His son was also sent to Anna Wakey as a teen. I asked him what it was like dealing with a child with emotional behavior issues and how he came to the conclusion to send him to Anna Wakey.
Oh, desperation, helplessness, anxiety, frustration. When people ask me that question about being a parent, and I tell them, look, we're not given any guidebooks to read how to be a parent. Okay? It's a daily experience. It's a constant struggle between your head and your heart, knowing what you should do, what you don't want to do. There was no place, as I look back, that I felt I could go to that could really help me. There are more programs today that are more advanced. There's more advancements about drug abuse. There's more what I would call openness in society. So the only thing you could do back then is trust your psychiatrist, who also was duped and knew nothing about what was going on at any of these places like Anna Wakey.
Richard says Anna Wakey was first presented to him by his son's psychiatrist. This would often be how children would get referred to Anna Wakey, through a doctor or teacher.
If I remember right, he described it as a psychiatric institute that can help him adjust or change his personality and behavior on a long-term treatment program. Okay? And I accepted that.
Richard and his wife visited the Anna Wakey campus for a tour before deciding whether to send their son there. This is how the Anna Wakey staff explained their treatment center.
They talked about the fact that it was a psychiatric facility. They forewarned us about the possibility of some of the incidents that occurred. And that is, we have to break down their personality We're going to read all the letters that come in, all the phone calls. There was no privacy. And we hope you expect that. They'll probably complain about some of these issues. All these things are normal. Now, at that point, I accepted it, knowing what I briefly knew about these kind of programs. Looking back now, I think it was one great anticipated thing they did so that you wouldn't question what they were really doing. So when your son came home and complained, they're abusing me and I want to leave and this is happening to me, you would just go back, well, look, he's got these psychiatric problems and needs treatment, and I'm assuming that what they told me is true, which we did. In retrospect, I have to say that based on my experience, they probably lied to us.
For parents dealing with an adolescent with emotional issues, they can often feel like they have nowhere to turn. Anna Wakey was the solution for many of these parents in Georgia in the 1960s through the 1980s. What was Anna Wakey doing to treat these children put under their control? Psychologist Roger Rinn explains the origins of wilderness therapy.
It's been a rule of thumb that if you get kids into the woods and impel them into some type of adventure, they do better, and that if they have delinquent proclivities, if they're going to break the law or become oppositional, they do much better, and that it's a great treatment. And since then, we found that that probably is the case if it's structured correctly and done right. There was a book called Wilderness Road, and as I recall, there was a businessman's club in Dallas, Texas that sponsored the original residential treatment center for kids, particularly boys. And our program at Anna Wakey was supposed to be designed after that program, and it was similar. The boys were required to build their own lodging. They did a lot of their own cooking. They had to make sure that they stayed in groups and worked in groups and teams. And putting the kids in the woods made sense.
Wilderness Road, published in 1965 by Campbell Locke Miller, has served as the manual for much of what we know today as wilderness therapy. Camp Woodland Springs was started in 1948 by Locke Miller as an expansion of a summer camp program he began with the Salesman's Club of Dallas, a group of business and professional men from the area. The parallels between Woodland Springs and Anna Wakey are numerous. From a campground setting where the children are in charge of their own lodging and meals, to isolating patients into groups, and even alluding to Native American terminology. Locke Miller was known around his camp as Chief Locke. The following is an excerpt from Wilderness Road.
We find the camp environment good because it accords more fully with the child's nature and provides ample opportunity to satisfy the desire most boys have for adventure and exploration in the outdoors. Small group living in this environment encourages original experimentation and provides the widest possible variety of direct experience with the natural surroundings. Such a life calls into play numerous individual skills, provides an outlet for almost any ability a boy may have, and constantly encourages new and ever-broadening experiences of the individual and the group. Life in this setting provides for the maximum variety, freshness, and intensity in the daily experience of each boy.
Most of Anna Wakey's therapy consisted of a daily group meeting at the end of each day, a time where the boys in your work or school group would sit around the fire and address any issues they encountered in their day.
After dinner, we had group therapy on logs, and that was just about every night. I worked with the staff. Everybody had two staff leaders, two group leaders in each group. So you'd have about eight kids and two adults, maybe 10 kids. And they would do group therapy and work on what went on that day and process the day.
Mark Butler attended Anna Wakey from 1984 to 1986. He remembers the group therapy, which was still taking place during his time there.
The guidance counselors would kind of push you along and, you know, help you get into things. And it was also a time to go over the day, what happened, were there any incidents, why did this happen? Because people got in trouble all the time.
These groups would serve an integral part to the Inawaiki program. Children were separated based on different factors such as age and whether they were in a work group or school group. Staying on brand, these groups were all given Native American names. Names such as Tawanka, Kurheed, and Wahanka.
Most of the groups at Inawaiki were done by age limits. Like Wahanka was the older groups, the one that went to school off campus, had the cars. Tawanka was the youngest, and it ranged from 8 till like 12 or 13. Then you had other groups that were ranging in groups like maybe 12 to 15, and 15 to 16 or 18. Tawanka, where I was at, was literal translations to attempt or undertake a difficult task. And like Inawaiki is supposed to be the land of the friendly people.
Here's journalist Albert Edgen, who reported on Inawaiki extensively for the Tallahassee Democrat.
They were broken up into groups, and the groups were designed for therapy and also for growth. So they had tasks they had to perform, and the groups monitored the behavior of the kids in the group. The groups were independent. They were not supposed to cross-pollinate. They were not supposed to talk to each other.
Mark Butler recalls this group structure and how it functioned during his time there.
I classify them into two groups, the work groups and the school groups. The work groups are always working. The school groups are always going to school. When I was there, I believe there was about 10 to 12 working groups, and there was no socializing between the groups. Of course, we did a little bit anyway. I guess they kept thinking that if they kept the group smaller and more contained, then it's much easier to handle, I guess. But then there was things like football, where there would have to be group mixing, you know, because football players come from different groups. So there was always some kind of talk between the groups.
The work group model would serve two functions at Inawaiki: to build what would become the largest medical facility in the state, and second, to help break down the patients so they could be remolded into the Inawaiki way of life. That was the idea, at least. Here's Mark Sublett, another former Inawaiki patient.
So if you had a building group, they might come in and you might do all the masonry. Okay, so you're the masonry group. So you cleared all the land, poured all the concrete foundations, hauled all the block out there, laid all the block, mixed all the mud, did all the plaster, did it all. And then another group might come behind you and they might be a carpentry group. So that's what they would do. And it seemed like sometimes the groups would split off and would help the electrician and be the electrical group. Same thing, pulling wire, doing all this stuff. I think Inawaiki's look on it was that they wanted to tell you, like, what we're going to do is make your life real shitty and you're going to hate it. So what would you want to do to get out of your shitty, hated life? And they told you that from the beginning, like, hey, from here on out, boy, you're going to have to work the rest of your life and you better get used to it. That's your life from here on out. Unless you go to school and get that education, then you might be able to do better. So kind of right off, they're feeding that into your mind.
This separation between work groups and school groups was the beginning of an involved hierarchy at Inawaiki. It was only after one had proven themselves through a series of tasks and personal development that they would receive a rite of passage all of the attendees were expected to achieve, to get your crest.
I don't think I've ever cried as much in my life as when he stood up when he got his crest, which is a certain achievement, and said, I'd like to thank my parents for loving me enough to send me here.
The crest would serve as one of the key elements of Inawaiki's mythos. An Inawaiki document called Legend of the Crest reads as follows.
The pine tree and red hill are the materials found in nature, which man may use according to his ability and ambition to improve the state of his existence in nature. The scroll depicts the democratic concept of the value of the individual and also the importance of one's relationship to other individuals. The winding path to the rising sun signifies the importance of striving toward a goal in life, using the self-discipline necessary to overcome obstacles which may present themselves in reaching of that goal. The praying hands show the need for a religious concept, the recognition of a power in the universe which is higher than the individual. The dove with the olive branch was selected from the story of Noah in the Bible to show that a new life in a clean, new world is possible.
The crest was not only a symbol of personal improvement and advancement in the program, but it was also required before a child could advance from a work group to a school group. Here's Stephen, another former Anawakey patient.
I was pretty much in a work group most of the time. That's another one of those themes, getting your crest or getting into a school group. It was a privilege. You had to work for it, so on and so forth. And I witnessed that some of these so-called privileges didn't turn out too well for other people. When I received my crest, they had a special Christmas dinner because I believe it took me longer to get the crest than anybody in Anawakey history. And, you know, there again, it was because I saw the guys that had worked towards that, and it didn't turn out too well for them.
Once a patient had proven themselves worthy of getting their crest, they would then move on to one of the school groups. The time frame from admittance until moving into a school group could often take years. During this time, no real schooling was a part of the child's schedule. In turn, grades would be caught up to in a span of months, even weeks, rather than years.
In the beginning, there was not a school. The little building in front of the lodge was a one little classroom. It had the possibility of being a school. At some point, they did get a teacher, but I never finished third, never went to fourth, never went to fifth, never went to sixth, never went to seventh. And when I got out of Anawakey, I should have, for my age, gone into the ninth. But they put me back in eighth because I hadn't been in school for so long. So when I went to high school, started out at eighth grade.
If you're willing to do whatever it took to get out of that work group, I mean, who wanted to haul block or sling blade 4 miles of road or whatever chore they would have for you that day. Of course, you're going to want to get out of that because you're a teenage kid. And, you know, so you'd be like, oh, what do I have to do to get into the school group? The school groups did no physical labor. All they would do is go to school. Now, they would tell you this crazy story, how you could do 4 years of education in 1 year at Anawakey. By the time I got the school group, I was already 3 years behind. So when I got out of there and tried to enroll in public school, and whatever my records were that came back from that, I was supposed to be a senior, but I'd be having to take ninth grade English, eighth grade this, 10th, 11th, 12th grade this. So it was just kind of screwed up. But that's how they would treat their school, is a privilege, a higher group of Anawakey kid. That's what you wanted to achieve.
The Anawakey program worked like a ladder, with a different rung for every advancement, giving more perks and power the further up you climbed. This hierarchy would go past the advancement of getting your crest and being promoted to a school group. Students could work their way up to becoming a group leader, or even a paid counselor.
You have one group, and everything works from the head leader of that group. And you also have a hierarchy of the kids. The new kid has to be taught by the next kid up what he's just learned. The next kid up has to be teaching that second kid down what he's just learned. Sort of a cascading system of learning. And it's important to remember that these were children. They may have been adolescents, but they were children. The counselor might have been 16 years old, responsible for a group of 15 or 20 youngsters, probably more likely as 18 years old, but not that much more mature, and certainly not experienced beyond the walls of Anawakey or bringing any real experience to the situation. There are all sorts of stories that they would tell you that I learned later, where activity would stop when somebody acted out. And sometimes with supervision from the group leader, sometimes with leadership from the members of the group, they would counsel the recalcitrant kid, whoever he may be. It was all an integrated system. It was innovative, but it was also subject for severe abuse in the sense that if you have a situation where the people that are being counseled are empowered to enforce rules, then you have to have stopgap measures. And I'm not sure they had those stopgap measures. You have to supervise the children that have been given these responsibilities. So one of the things that deteriorated through the years was that the management, and by management, I mean Lewis Petter, would promote children to the status of counselor. And that appeared to be, in many cases, without any substantial training. The fact is that a lot of these children who became counselors were incapable of dealing with situations because they hadn't been trained to. And having a kid manage a situation, that can only come from the kid's gut. It can't come from training or any kind of knowledge. It was an ad hoc system.
Here to talk about Anoike and Lewis Petter.
This is Robert. He worked at Anoike as a group leader in the late 1960s.
I'm Robert D'Agostino. I'm a law professor at John Marshall Law School, and I've been there since 1995, where I came in as I was dean and president for 5 years, and now I'm just a mere professor sitting in my corner office, not being pestered by the administration.
Robert originally heard about Anoike through social work with a branch of local government called the Department of Family and Children's Services, or as it is known, DFACS.
Probably 68 or 69. I'd been a social worker, and I had heard about treatment centers for allegedly delinquent boys. Some of them weren't really delinquent. They just didn't have a home to go to. I had a very bright patient, I guess I should call him, who had no place to live. And I said, well, I got to put him someplace. I heard about Anoike through the social work, through the information held by the Department of Family and Children's Services. And so I went to see Anoike. I met Louis Petter, and we talked about the program, and Petter made me an offer. He offered me a position there as a teacher, because I had my teaching credentials that I taught in high schools.
Robert says the idea of working with at-risk youth in an outdoor setting was something that interested him right away.
When I first started to work there, I had a group. And we lived in tents in Douglasville in the Anoike real estate. And I had that job, and I also was the head teacher. And as it turned out, I was the only teacher. As far as training was concerned, there wasn't any. I had a co-counselor with me and with the boys. There's, I think, 10 or 12 boys in that group. He had boys separated into different groups, maybe five or six different groups. So I was directly in charge of one group, but I was the teacher for all the groups. Slowly but surely, first thing I did out there was supervise the boys in building. It was really a lot of fun. And I'm not very skilled, but I can carry things around and hammer a nail. And after we built the building, it was time to go on the canoe trip. Petter had talked about taking a bunch of boys on an outward bound type trip. And we talked about, Suwannee River. I always wanted to canoe the whole Suwannee. I'd been down there, and lo and behold, I did. We did started at the Okefenokee Swamp and went down to the Gulf of Mexico. So off we go. So I'm gone for the next 3 weeks or more, because at the end of the canoe trip, we stayed at a motel owned by Anoike in Carrabelle, or is either owned by Anoike or Lewis Petter.
Robert is referring to Carrabelle, Florida. This was the beginning of what would become a second campus for Anoike. At the time, it was no more than a motel on the Gulf of Mexico, in the Panhandle region of Florida. Robert says it was during his time on this canoe trip that he first started to think something wasn't right with Petter and his relationship with some of the boys.
I had an inkling of that down at Carrabelle. I thought that some of the behavior of Louis Petter was probably inappropriate, too much touching. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, give a kind of fatherly hug. It's another thing to put your hands on people a little bit too much.
Roger Wren, who we first heard at the beginning of this episode, also worked with Robert at Anoike at this time. They both began to sense that something was off.
Bob was hired about 7 months after I had arrived, maybe six. And he and I became immediate friends. He's really a fine human being. And Bob and I saw eye to eye, and we started talking and saying, what do you think's going on? And then we started having some strong suspicions that things were awry, and what we thought was going on in therapy was really not therapy at all.
One thing that first fed the suspicion was the fact that certain children would stay at Lewis Petter's house on the weekend.
I didn't like it that the kids would go to his house, a specific kid would go to his house and spend a weekend or maybe a week with him. I questioned several staff members, what's that all about? And he gives them special therapy on the weekends. There was one fellow there who I thought was very ethical, very competent with the kids, and he really ran the day-to-day program there, and he was just about as fine as he could be. And I asked him about it, and he said, I think he does individual therapy with them.
The counselor Roger is referring to is Brett Baxley, or as he was known on campus, Mr. B. Everyone I've interviewed says that Baxley was a stand-up guy who really cared about the kids and teaching them. Baxley's history with Petter went back to the beginning of Anawakie. He even helped with the original land acquisition. What Baxley and Petter's relationship was like is still a bit of a mystery. What we do know is that for whatever reason, Baxley never questioned Petter's actions. Roger Wrenn and Robert D'Agostino co-chaperoned the canoe trip down the Suwannee River. It was at the destination in Carrabelle, Florida, that their suspicion of abuse came to a head.
Bob Camp, I don't know how to use his name, but he was down there, and he was there was a relationship between Louis Petter and Bob Camp, which I thought was a little off, that something was wrong. Again, the touching, Bob Camp's demeanor. At one point, Roger Wrenn saw Bob Camp and Louis Petter in bed together.
Roger Wrenn initially saw this incident with Petter. He quickly grabbed Bob D'Agostino to confirm what his own eyes had seen.
They were lying down together in the same bed, even though there was plenty of beds around. Kind of start wondering what the heck was going on. But that was the first inkling. And it happened early on, I must say. But it took me a while to really figure out exactly what was going on.
Roger Wrenn remembers this incident firsthand.
Bob and I found him in the morning in bed with one of the kids. And I don't want to get graphic, but it was pretty rough. And that's when Bob and I sort of said, uh-oh. Then we knew. There was no question. I've absolutely had nightmares about it for several years. If I think about it now, I get the heebie-jeebies. It's just not a pleasant thing. The day in which that occurred, I just went berserk. I mean, I was not myself, and I'm usually fairly well controlled, but I was so emotional I couldn't stop. And Bob, too. Bob and I were both mad. And he just flat denied it, kept denying it, and said, that's not what you saw. And that's when we sort of agonized. I said, I'm going to get out of here. But Bob and I decided, how are we going to protect these children? Because they were 13-year-old kids. There were some that were even 11. And I thought, I can't leave them here. After that, I was trying to ask Bob, and Bob was asking me, what should we do? Should we quit, or should we stay here and try to help the kids? What's our role?
D'Agostino and Wrenn both decided to stay on at Anawakie for the time being. They needed to find out what else was going on.
When I got back there, I had a lot of work to do at Anawakie, setting up the school and all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, things went on maybe a month or so. I got the school going. Mostly I was with the group or the school back and forth. Then I started to notice that Louis Petter had this group of boys around him, and it's the same group. I said to one of them, why are you always with Dr. I had to call him Dr. Petter because that's what he wanted to be called, even though he's no PhD. He said, well, we live with Dr. Petter. I said, what? He said, yeah, three or four of them. We live at his house with him. I said, you live with his house with him? Is this just temporarily, or have you been there for a long time? And at least two of them said, no, they'd been there for quite a while. They lived with him for quite a while. Well, next from there, I started to watch Petter. Every time he came on campus, I kept my eyeball on Petter, and I talked to Roger Wrenn, who also had a group assigned to him besides being a psychologist. And my group and Roger's group were off bounds. He couldn't go near him. I wouldn't let him near my group.
It's worth noting here that Petter was an amputee from childhood, with a wooden leg where his limb once was.
There was one incident where my group was assigned a new kid, tall, good-looking fella, kind of muscular. And I can remember this incident really well. There was a gang shower. Each group would go in and have a gang shower. And of course, Louis was prone to, walk into the gang shower, supervise things. My group's in the gang shower, and I know Louis is zeroing in on this new kid. And Louis was about to go into the shower. And I said, Dr. Petter, I don't think you should go in there. He said, oh, why not? I said, it's my group in there. And remember, I told you before, my group is under my protection. You're not going in there. And I know what you're going in there for. And I said, Louis, I'm going to tell you something. You go in there, and you touch that kid, and you try to abuse that kid. You know your wooden leg? I'm going to saw it off and throw it in the lake.
While Rin and D'Agostino knew that Petter was having inappropriate relations with students, there were other counselors they were afraid may also be taking advantage of the children.
Look, some of the counselors out there were pretty good. Roger, of course, was good. There was another counselor who I thought was really top flight. And I think he was a homosexual, but I know he never touched the kids. I just don't know what Petter had on Baxley and why Baxley, who was a decent human being in every other way, would have cooperated with Petter, what he was doing. I just don't understand it. Never could. There was no indication that Baxley ever abused anyone. And then there was Sam. There was a couple of other ones out there who were just bad news. Sam was the worst. Sam Singleton. Sam Singleton was a counselor and a serial abuser of the kids. And I brought that up with Louis Petter. And of course, his reaction was, well, I'll talk to him. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I'm an old social worker. I can tell what's going on. And I eventually confronted Sam Singleton about this. In fact, I kicked him off the campus. I had no authority, but I kicked him off campus anyway. And Louis, of course, brought her back. A couple of weeks later, 2-3 weeks later, he brought her back. Sam was after this kid, Mike. Apparently, Sam decided to have the hots for him. And I told Sam at one point that if he touched Mike, I would break his neck. He just walked away. He knew I was serious.
Shortly after this time, Roger Rin had reached his breaking point. He recalls his resignation with Petter.
After a while, it became apparent that he and I were going to be completely persona non grata. We were not going to be allowed to do anything. We had no power. I said, I can't tolerate this. And he said, goodbye. After that, I got out of there.
Roger was not the only one who had had enough. D'Agostino remembers the mood at Anoka'i at the time.
Miss Ogletree, who was then the social worker, she was a delightful woman, and she was a good social worker, a good person. When she figured out that I wasn't one of the bad guys, she said to me, as soon as she finds a new job, she's getting out of there. Miss Ogletree had left. She had fled. Roger Wren had quit. So my allies were gone, and Baxley would do nothing. The head counselor, I asked him, I said, Why are you letting this happen? Why are you letting this happen? Why are you covering up for Louis Petter? And he had no answer to that question. But I asked him, why are you allowing Louis to do this stuff? Why are you allowing this? This could be a good place. This could be a wonderful place. But it's not because of what Louis's doing. And you can stop him. You can keep him away.
Robert says his relationship with Petter remained tense during his last days at Anoka'i.
Well, after I threatened to cut his leg off, let's say our relationships became rather frosty. And interestingly enough, of course, he didn't fire me because he really thought he was untouchable.
Eventually, Robert left the camp as well. He and Roger knew that something had to be done about what they had witnessed at Anoka'i.
And that's when we started making as much effort as we could. And we were young, remember, we're 25-year-old kids, and we're scared. And the whole process was frightening from a personal point of view, because I'm a graduate student. I don't have any power. But we did have an enormous amount of energy, and we tried everything we could.
Just after I left Anoka'i, I went to DFACS and complained about what was going on.
We went to the sheriff. I believe his name was Abercrombie. And remembering that Louis Petter was also a Baptist minister, and he had strong standing in the community in Douglasville. We brought 80 kids to church every Sunday to the Baptist church, so it was a big deal. And nothing happened at the sheriff's office, nothing happened. We went to the state child welfare program. They didn't want to hear it. We went to the newspaper, to the Atlanta Journal. We went to an attorney all by ourselves, and we went in, and the guy says, he didn't want any part of it.
Rin and D'Agostino had made up their minds. Something had to be done about the abuse taking place at Anawake. It seemed everywhere they turned, nobody would listen to their story. That is, until a patient would finally come forward. Next time, on Camp Hell, Anawake.
I just thought that people would be really upset about this. I thought people would rise up and do something about it. Nothing was done.
We were involved in trying to find some way to extricate him from the camp. You cannot imagine knowing something that is horrendous and telling people, in fact, screaming, and nobody listening.
Very meticulous about maintaining relationships with people who were in positions of power.
The Department of Family and Children's Services actually placed boys in that camp, even though they knew about what he did in Savannah.
And finally, I think they were embarrassed at the point where they had to hold a hearing.
The defense lawyers for Anawake, for the accused, used information about their pathologies to discredit them, to question their credibility, and to humiliate them.
In last week's episode, you heard from Dale Strickland, one of the very first attendees of Anawake. We were recently informed that Dale passed away shortly after his interview, before the podcast was able to come out. We would like to dedicate this episode to Dale and his memory, and thank him for his involvement in the podcast.
Camp Hell, Anawake was created and hosted by Josh Thane, with producer Miranda Hawkins and executive producers Alex Williams and Matt Frederick. The soundtrack was written and performed by Josh Thane and Adrian Barry. This episode featured the voices of Matt Frederick and Ben Bolin. Archival footage provided by WSB and CBS News. Find us on Instagram at Camp Hell Pod. That's CampHellPod. Educate yourself about the issue of child abuse and things that you should look for at the Darkness to Light website, d2l.org. That's d2l.org. Camp Hell, Anawake is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.